Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations put out by Target Books from 1973 onward in publication order. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. At the time of recording, I am speaking to you from L.I. Who. This is the 10th anniversary of the first L.I. Who convention, which was held in Suffolk County, Long Island, New York, in November 2013. This year, the con has moved up to August, presumably for better weather. This is the 9th L.I. Who. They missed a couple of years. This is my 8th one attending. I have been doing lots of recording this weekend, a couple of guest interviews, a couple of panels. I will have all that material out on a later date, possibly as part of a bonus episode, possibly interspersed with regular book episodes. This week is episode 87, my long-awaited look at Warriors of the Deep, one of those Doctor Who stories of which I have very, very fond childhood memories and a deep, abiding respect for, if not love, today. This is not a majority opinion, one would say. I am going to defend Warriors of the Deep as best I can. Joining me is UK Jason, a partner in crime from the Trap One podcast. You have heard him on this show before. This is his second, and hopefully not his final, appearance. We had a great time recording this episode a few weeks ago, talking about Doctor Who's ratings in the 1980s and Warriors of the Deep, and several related and unrelated topics. One of our main themes in the conversation is how Warriors of the Deep may be the quintessential 1980s Doctor Who story. To that end, you will notice that our original opening song, recorded and performed by Jim Sangster, is of a very, very 1980s vibe. The 80s was the first decade for which I was alive every single day, and in many ways it is still the 1980s up in my brain. So the costumes and graphics in Warriors of the Deep make me feel like I am home. Granted, not too many other fans feel that way. Last week, episode 86, The Dominators, Fraser Gregory and I were on very opposite ends of the "Is the Dominators a good story?" coin. I did not change Fraser's mind, and Fraser did not change my mind. But we had a great time recording, and feedback and listening numbers for that episode are excellent, so hopefully you enjoyed the conversation as well. Meanwhile, I will keep this intro short. I have had a very busy weekend at L.I. Who. I am on 7 panels, 6 of which I am moderator. Had one of those Friday, 3 today, the Saturday, as I record this just after midnight, and 3 more on Sunday. I will have more information for you about that with next week's episode and as the L.I. Who material gets aired on this podcast. Meanwhile, today, it's the 1980s. It's the Terence Dix novelization of Warriors of the Deep. Let's get to it.
A Whovian and a Nuvian walk into a TARDIS
and explore every episode of the classic Doctor Who series.
Join me, podcaster John S. Drew,
and me, writer-editor Jim Beard, as we take apart each story starting from the very beginning in 1963.
And join us on our Facebook page and Twitter, where we continue the discussion with you with historical artifacts from British papers of the time. The Doctor's Beard Podcast, released every Saturday around tea time on your favorite podcasting app.
And we'll see you in time and space. You're listening to Doctor Who Literature. Keep turning the pages.
While having the name Jason and being the host of Doctor Who Literature is a lot of fun, I enjoy it even more when there are two Jasons on the show at the same time. So I welcome back to Doctor Who Literature my partner in crime from Trap One, UK, Jason. Jason, welcome back.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been brilliant to come back, and thank you very much for having me.
last time that I had you on the show was a few months ago. What was the book we talked about?
The Stones of Blood.
The Stones of Blood. That was the tail end of 2022, very beginning of 2023. That would have been episode 55 of this podcast. And here we are, more than half a year later, talking about book 87. Not a lot of similarities between Stones of Blood and Warriors of the Deep, are there?
Not a lot. They're completely two different stories, aren't they? You know, obviously, kind of like the Stones of Blood is carrying on that kind of like that gothic style that we had in the Hinchcliffe and Holmes era, but then does a twist with the space station in the final episode. This one is completely full sci-fi, full in very 80s style. It's the East and the West. It's very Cold War inspired. And it's kind of like coasting on the success of Earthshock, isn't it? I feel.
It's interesting because you've had a complete turnover two or three times of the production team. Graham Williams is gone. His replacement, John Nathan Turner, is now in charge. Anthony Reed, who would have been script editor for Stones of Blood, is now gone. He's been replaced several times. And now it's Eric Sayward putting his stamp on the show. And you have Johnny Byrne, who had not yet joined Doctor Who when Stones of Blood is made. This is his third story in four seasons, and it's also his final Doctor Who TV script, because there was a lot of bad blood between him and Eric Sayward, which I will get into much later on in this particular episode. We have Johnny Byrne's thoughts about the TV production of Warriors of the Deep. But yeah, you're right. This is an Earthshock style story with monsters and a high body count and a tragedy that spirals out of control, which the Doctor is completely powerless to stop, which is kind of a running theme of the Eric Sayward years. But when you go back to Stones of Blood, Tom Baker was never playing the kind of Doctor who could let things get out of control and rarely ended in tragedy, and always had a firm handle on proceedings. So the changeover in Doctors is very marked between Stones and Warriors.
Yeah, I mean, it continues that vulnerability of the Fifth Doctor that we'd kind of like seen straight from the off with Castrovalva. And, you know, and it's an intriguing and different interpretation. I don't think a lot of people would have said, had they gone with a similar kind of actor or a similar kind of presentation of the character, the show probably wouldn't have been as successful as, like, you know, certainly that first Peter Davison series was, when like the ratings went straight back up to, like, you know, 9, 10, almost 11 million. I think, they then settled down for season 20 and 21. But, yeah, it continues that kind of, like, whole ethos that, you know, the Doctor doesn't always win. And I think this is probably one of those key stories for that.
And this has a negative effect on the future of Doctor Who, because the replacement Doctor for Peter Davison, Colin Baker, is going to be consciously molded by Eric Sayward to be much more of a fighter, much more caustic, much more abrasive. And this is a bit of the future of Doctor Who literature, but you go from a Doctor who selflessly gives himself up to save Perry in part four of Caves of Androzani, and then literally 6 days later in production time, you have the Sixth Doctor trying to strangle Perry in the TARDIS console room, steps from where he saved her life 1 week or 6 days earlier. And then the rest of season 22 is a brutal, graphic, violent fest. So between that and the Mirka in this story, Michael Grade says enough is enough. And if you look at the ratings for Warriors, it's the season premiere. Mm-hmm. But it goes from 7.6 million to 6.6 million viewers over the course of the 2 weeks that it airs, which is basically half of what Doctor Who was getting in seasons 15, 16, and 17 when Tom Baker was still firmly very much the Doctor.
Yeah, it's interesting you touch upon the ratings there, because obviously from a UK perspective, when this first aired, I have distinct recollections that the show was still popular, and I would have been just turned 11 at the time of, like, Warriors going out. Obviously, you know, November would have been the time that I just before the 20th anniversary story, the Five Doctors, would have been when I turned 11. It was still popular with kind of like, you know, my friends, you know, in the school yard, you know, we still talked about the show. But I distinctly recall from this season onwards, and part of it was this story, there was a distinct shift in certain friends of mine or other kids that I knew that started to now drift away from the show. And we could probably talk about the production aspects of the show, which probably contribute to that.
Yes.
A big factor was, you'll probably know this show, the A-Team started to be shown in some regions of ITV, up against on Friday nights, up against directly against Doctor Who. So obviously, I think if you analyse the ratings for the Thursday nights showings for Doctor Who, because it went out Thursdays and Fridays for this season, except for Resurrection of the Daleks, which was weekly and on a Wednesday. The Thursday ratings tend to be always higher than the Friday ratings because it's not got much competition on the Thursday. But the Friday, it was coming up against the A-Team. The A-Team was like this big, kind of like cool American show that, you know, had mindless violence in it and, you know, Mr. T playing a cool character. And you could see how kids like started to move away from the shoddy production values of Doctor Who, unfortunately, and then go for the glitz and glamour of a, you know, an American show. It's kind of like the same thing happened in 1980 when ITV put Buck Rogers up against the early half of season 18.
Interesting about the ratings because, so interesting to look at the ratings. If you look at the ratings for Twin Dilemma, which is the end of the season begun by Warriors of the Deep, part one of Twin Dilemma is on par with Warriors. You have 7.6 million viewers. I don't know if it's the A-Team effect or just the fact that the story was not very well received. Part four of Twin Dilemma drops all the way down to 6.3 million viewers, and that's March 30th, 1984. Now, I was expecting to see that in season 22, the ratings would have gone into the tank. What's odd is that the final story of season 22, the last broadcast story for a year and a half when the show was essentially canceled by Michael Grade, the show is now back on Saturday night. Revelation of the Daleks draws 7.4 and 7.7 million viewers. So my takeaway here is that the ratings for seasons 21 and 22, there are some peaks and valleys, but they stay within the same range. And the opening story of 21 and the closing story of 22 draw comparable ratings. But the prevailing wisdom in the C-suite is that the show is poorly made, too violent, nobody likes it, why are we spending our money on this? So the ratings don't seem to match the overall narrative that this is what gets Doctor Who killed. Michael Grade turning on his TV and seeing the Merkel lumbering across the screen like a pantomime horse, and then the over-the-top violence of the Colin Baker era, which you can lay at the feet of Eric Saward, who was perhaps going too far to the other extreme to counteract what Peter Davison had done.
Yeah, probably very, very true with that. You know, it's interesting that obviously the you say the ratings remain kind of like very, very steady. And I think actually what happened going into season 22 is once they announced the kind of like, well, at the time it was a cancellation and they kind of backtracked and said it was on hiatus, that actually gave the show a bit of a bounce. Because I think we'd started off very healthy with about 8 million, hadn't it? Attack of the Cybermen, episode one. Then obviously it just, you know, evened off a little bit to around about 7 million. Two Doctors was around about 6-ish. And then it gets announced that it's being canned. And then you kind of like, then you get a kind of artificial bounce towards the end, like you said, with Revelation of the Daleks, then going back up. But season 22 also had its own competition because it was then up against Robin of Sherwood, which was a hugely popular show in 1985. And that was like getting views of around about, I think, about 10 11 million viewers on ITV. But it's interesting that with it moving back to Saturday nights weren't kind of like dominated by BBC One like they were in the 1970s. ITV were kind of like fighting back and had like their other shows, you know, which like, you know, stuff like Blind Date and Game for a Laugh and Beatles About, which were big rating successes. So it's kind of like you then have this kind of like battleground between BBC and ITV where the BBC haven't got the dominance on a Saturday night that they used to have into the 1970s, into the early 1980s. So that, I think, plays into the whole like perception of the show, because then people aren't like, you know, tuning in at the beginning of the evening and staying with a particular channel. And then obviously you've then got the perception that Doctor Who is like, it's old, it's cheesy, it's the special effects are poor. And I think that's, that perception's come from obviously people talking about, you know, Star Wars and all the special effects, like that kind of thing. And I think Doctor Who made its mistake, I think, with John Nathan Turner's direction in trying to always compete with that. So we need more sci-fi stories. We need, that's what's popular. We need some like stories that are set in the future. We need some stories that are set in space. Whereas like it, if it played more, I think, on its strengths and done like kind of like more historical shows like, you know, The Visitation, you know, which plays better to, you know, the production values of the BBC at the time, then I think it might have actually fared a little bit better.
So really interesting points. Let's talk about those one by one. So you're exactly right about Attack of the Cybermen, which is the season 22 premiere. And yes, the show is now back on Saturday night for the first time in 4 years. And it's now a 45-minute show rather than 25 minutes. Attack of the Cybermen Part 1 gets ratings of 8.9 million viewers, which is great. And I'll be honest, as critical as I am and as critical as I will be of Season 22 when the books get there, Attack of the Cybermen Part 1 is amazing. It's really good. The heist stuff is terrific. Matthew Robinson is director. No scene runs more than 45 seconds. It moves. Part 2 of Attack of the Cybermen, which is not as good as Part 1 because all the best characters are killed off in the first half hour, the ratings for Part 2 drop all the way down to 7.2 million. Now, of course, they bounce back by the end of the year. But you make good points about the competition from ITV. Now, being in the States, I don't have that perspective. I'm watching the shows on PBS. I'm one of very few people watching the shows on PBS at that point. But in the mid-80s, America goes from three stations, ABC, CBS, and NBC, three networks, and then odd syndicated channels. In 1986, you get the fourth network, the Fox network, which is still around. Then you also have the proliferation of cable TV. So in the late 70s, I had a black and white television, which went on VHF from channels 2 through 13. And then there's UHF, most of the channels of which are blank. Or public access. And then you get cable, and all of a sudden I have a cable box that goes from channels 2 through 37. So there's a lot more going on. And Doctor Who was on channel 21. Channel 20 was another PBS station out of Boston where I could watch Dark Shadows. Channel 22 is Nickelodeon with all the kids stuff. So in that three-button range on my old wired remote control, 20, 21, 22, there's suddenly a lot more competition than I would have had 10 years earlier when I only have three networks to watch. So in terms of what that means for Doctor Who, the ratings are good, but the perception of the show, because there's so much more competition now, is that the show is bad, even though the same number of folks are watching it week in and week out. Whereas in the States, Doctor Who was always a cult show because it wasn't aired on the networks. It was on PBS. It was a niche show, and most folks are watching the big primetime network sitcoms of the mid-80s. When I was coming to school talking Doctor Who, my friends are watching ALF, they're watching Golden Girls, and of course A-Team was much bigger in the early 80s. There were a lot of A-Team toys, there were A-Team commercials,
cereal as well, probably.
Yes, there was certainly an A-Team breakfast cereal. There was Gremlins the movie breakfast cereal. No Doctor Who breakfast cereal. So in terms of Warriors of the Deep, you and I are about the same age. I saw this for the first time in late 1984. I had just turned 11. You would have seen this probably on the original airing, January 1984, right?
Yeah, like I said, I remember it, like, you know, it being trailed, Doctor Who's coming back. By that point, obviously, with the Peter Davison era, we'd gotten into the habit of, instead of it airing through September through to about March, it was condensed because it was twice weekly. So we always knew that it around about just after Christmas, January time, was when the show was always going to come back and air. So it settled into that first 3 months of the year where you got a big quick chunk of Doctor Who, and obviously, you know, being as kids, it was great that it was on twice a week because you got to see twice as much Doctor Who. But in the long run, I think that probably hurt the show because then it's not on the air as much as what it was previously during the John Pertwee and the Tom Baker years, where it was on for 6 months of the year. You know, talking to a condensed period where it's only on for just over 3 months of the year, you know. So, but I definitely remember it being on. I remember watching it, and I remember really enjoying it. It's interesting that obviously I rewatched it yesterday, and I've not watched it for quite some time. How just it's a very earth-shocky style story. It's building on those successes. It's bringing back an old monster. It's doing that the Doctor trapped in an area with his companions, up against it, trying to make some allies who don't trust him initially, and almost a Base Under Siege story. But all the stuff that Earthshock got right, you know, with the reveals, the mystery, you know, that great shock ending at episode one, where suddenly it's oh my God, it's the Cybermen, which I remember distinctly as a kid and absolutely going, you know, running around the room going, the Cybermen are back, you know, I probably would have done, being 7, 8 years old at the time. But here, Pennant Roberts, as the director, just cuts straight to the Silurian ship and literally just have the Silurians, you know, just walking in shot. There's no suspense. There's no oh my God, you know, it's oh, there they are. It's really chalk and cheese. I mean, and it's a shame because Johnny Byrne's got a cracking story, it really is, but I think it's execution onto screen, it's really let down. And I thought when I dipped into the Target novel again, I thought Terrence Dix would rectify some of that, but he doesn't. He does a very similar job of sticking to the shooting script, and he does and the opening couple of paragraphs establishing the sea base, and then just goes straight into, and here are the Silurians. And it's not until later on in the book that he then gives you a bit of background about the Silurians.
That's a point that I want to make during the second half of the show when I read out my audio essay, because Terrence commissioned the Silurians in 1970. He commissioned the Sea Devils in 1972. He knows more about them than anybody else who either wrote Warriors of the Deep or who was in studio for the weeks that it was being shot for the two studio blocks. So Terrence is the right person to novelize this book, even if he only got the commission by accident because Johnny Byrne was not doing any of his own novelization adaptations. But it's a really good point that you make about the lack of a surprise reveal, because we're just coming off the 20th anniversary season. Every bit of season 20 has an element that's coming back, and every season 20 story has some shock cliffhanger. Part 3 of Ark of Infinity, OMG, it's Omega. Part 1 of Modern Undead, in the name of all that is evil, I, the Black Guardian, command you.
And of course, Earthshock in season 19 has that great surprise Cyberman cliffhanger in part one.
Tika, no!
Doctor!
There's nothing we can do!
We can't just leave him!
Face it, Tika! He's drowned!
I mean, when I went to school the next day with my two Doctor Who fan friends who had just got me into the show, all I could talk about was that cliffhanger, and does that mean the Doctor is dead? Did he really drown? Is he going to regenerate? You do not see any Silurians or Sea Devils in shot. Either that's a lack of imagination on the part of the writer and script editor. You can't imagine that if Terrence Dix was still the script editor, he ever would have allowed that to happen. Or maybe they were just tired of these reunion specials, and even though season 21 is opening as if it's left over from season 20, maybe they want to downplay the returning monster elements. But you're right, that is a big conceptual failure on the part of the story. The Murka gets a cliffhanger, but it's not designed and built like a monster that's worthy of a cliffhanger reveal. And the Silurians only get two scenes with the Doctor, and that's both in part four at the very end of the story. Now, granted, we flash forward to the year 2022, and Legends of the Sea Devil is a disappointment for a lot of different reasons. So it's hard to blame Classic Who for doing a bad job of bringing back the Sea Devils when New Who is not doing that much better of a job bringing them back out of the mothballs. But again, we're being very critical. I want to take away all this hindsight. I want to take away this talk of Michael Grade and the ratings. As you are watching this, in January 1984, are you saying this is just as good as the show that I remember? Or are you saying, oh my goodness, the show has suddenly gone from being amazing in the Five Doctors to being horrible 6 weeks later, I'm never going to watch the show again? Did Warriors of the Deep have any positive or negative effect on you in 1984? Or is it just another story in a long line of stories that you enjoyed?
I definitely recall it having a positive effect because, like I said, you know, being steeped in, obviously, you know, the books and obviously, you know, the Doctor and the Cave Monsters and obviously having the Doctor and the Sea Devils and knowing, like, the background of those two stories from reading the Target novels of those two books. And obviously, you used to get regular articles in Doctor Who Weekly, then Doctor Who Monthly, and they had some nice backups. Comic strips where they'd focus on like the monsters, and I definitely recall they did a very, very good one with the Silurians and also a very good one with the Sea Devils as well. I might be wrong. I think one of them was written by Alan Moore because he was writing for the comics at the time. He was writing for Marvel UK. It was just before, obviously, he then made the tradition the move over to DC in the US.
And took Dave Gibbons with him. And Dave Gibbons had also been on the Doctor Who strip.
He had, yeah, yeah. He did those very early strips with Tom Baker and then did the transition from Tom Baker to Pete Davidson before he then moved, I think, to Steve Ridgway, who then became the artist. But yeah, I was loving it. You know, I didn't see like the faults of like the fact that, you know, they'd introduced the Silurians very like clumsily. It was like, oh no, my cool, oh, the Silurians are back. And then suddenly they mentioned the Sea Devils, and then you see that I love the Sea Devils in hibernation. And I love the new look of them. That was very like kind of like samurai inspired, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. And I was just loving the show. Like you say, that cliffhanger was absolutely really, really memorable. Even though you wouldn't employ Turlough as a lifeguard, because literally after about 5 seconds of being in water, he literally says, "Face it, Tegan, he's drowned." It's like, give him a chance, will you?
By the way, A+ on the Mark Strickson impression. That was very good.
Thank you. But yeah, even the Murka, I don't recall like, you know, recalling at that and like being in fits of laughter or something. But you know, whether obviously it was a change for my other friends and stuff. I mean, some of them kept with the show throughout the rest of the season, but I definitely remember there being a kind of like a bit of a huge exodus once Peter Davison had left and Colin Baker came in. And that last kind of like the story, the twin dilemma, not being popular with my school friends at all. But yeah, it was still great. It was still, you know, it's on twice a week. It's fantastic. Oh, wow, the Silurians are back. The Sea Devils are back. You know, there's lots of action in it. It's not filmed as brilliantly as Peter Grimway did in Earthshock, but it's still exciting, you know, for, like, you know, kids to watch as I was watching it. So I wasn't making any dispersions that the show was awful at that point at all.
And same with me. I unreservedly loved Warriors of the Deep when I watched it in late 1984. And it wasn't until I got to Rec Arts Doctor Who in the early 90s that I had the intimation that this story was quote-unquote considered a bad one. Discontinuity Guide enjoys Warriors of the Deep a lot more than I thought they would. But if you look at the... I don't know where it ranked on the most recent... Ooh, I see you have Discontinuity Guide in front of you.
Uh-huh.
Nice. I only have a digital copy at this point. My paper copy was lost in the great purge of Jason stuff earlier this year.
Oh, dear.
But I don't know where Warriors ranks in the latest DWM poll, since I am not a subscriber. But I know that the 2019 and the 2014 surveys, it ranked very, very, very low. And that probably has to do with perceptions of the story and perceptions of the Merkabah. But you and I, as kids, we're watching it in 1984. And it worked for both of us. So let's talk about some other criticisms of the story and try and dispose of them. But first, tangentially, I like the point you raise about the backup strips in DWM. Bearing in mind, I did not know about Doctor Who Monthly in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't see my first issue of that magazine until the 1990s. And to this day, I'm not even a subscriber. I'll buy the odd issue at Forbidden Planet NYC sometimes if there's an interesting cover. Yeah. However, we did have, in the States, Marvel Comics US put out a short-lived monthly Doctor Who book. It was the DWM comic colorized and the backup strip and a few columns from American writers and reviews. And it ran for 23 issues. And I didn't find out about this until a comic shop opened in my corner of Long Island right next to the Kosher Deli where we had dinner every Friday night. So we parked the car one night, and all of a sudden, boom, there's a comic shop next door to Boomies. Run into the comic shop, and I got my parents to buy me 20, issues 20, 21, and 22, all at the same time. And they all came, they were back issues, so they came in the plastic sleeve.
Yeah.
I was never able to find 23, which wound up being the final issue. But the editor's note in 22 says, this title is not selling very well, and it might not be around much longer. When I was at my one and only New York Comic Con in 2019, right before the pandemic, I finally got the missing issue 23, and that was the last one. But that includes the last of Peter Davison. So I have the Stockbridge Horror, I have the whole Stockbridge cycle, which is issues 20 through 22, and I have some of the backup strips. The only backup strip that I can remember is the Celestial Toymaker one, and I really, really like that. I don't think I've ever seen the backup strips with the Silurians and Sea Devils, because while IDW took all those DWM strips and released them as Doctor Who Classics about 10, 15 years ago,
yeah.
So we have everything from Iron Legion all the way through Tides of Time, all the way up through Seventh Doctor. I don't think that those backup strips have ever been compiled. And if I'm wrong, I would love to know and buy them. But I don't think those backup strips are commercially available.
Yeah, I think I've not seen them reprinted, and I do have that 23 issue run of the Marvel US reprints.
Oh wow!
They're up in the loft with all my other comics, to be quite honest, all bagged and boarded. But yeah, I do have that run, and I did pick up some of the IDW reprints as well. And like you say, it's a shame that they haven't been more, like, you know, widely reprinted, because you've got some absolutely classic backup strips there. You know, that's where Absalom Dak came from, you know, the Dalek killer. He came from one of those backup strips.
And he survived into the New Adventures, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. Croton, the Cyberman with emotions, he came from, you know, those backup strips as well. So there's loads of interesting stuff that they did. They did a really good one that I can recall, which was a unit doing an investigation of a plastics factory, which obviously then turned out to be the Autons. Mm. You know, and that was kind of like, essentially, it was like Spearhead from Space, but without the Doctor in it. And I think the twist in the end of it, because they always tend to like sometimes end with a twist, because they were quite, you know, 8 pages long, and kind of like, if they weren't a multi-part one, that it's kind of like, the last panel would always be a twist. And I think I remember, I might be completely misremembering this completely, but I think it ended up with the unit undercover person being replaced by an Auton. And then that was the twist. And then they went back out into the thing. It was like, oh, right, okay. You know, and obviously you're thinking, well, perhaps that leads somewhere into a future Doctor Who comic strip. And it never did.
That's great. I mean, I would love to read some of those again. I don't have issues 20 through 22 anymore. Those probably got lost in the Great Purge of early 2023. There's one tranche of my old childhood possessions that I still have in another state, but I haven't been in there in years. So I know I have 23. I don't know if I have 20 through 22 anymore, but I read them over and over again, and I would act out the Stockbridge horror. It really spoke to me as a kid. So let's turn back to Warriors of the Deep then. The other big criticism of the story is that Seabase 4 is too darn bright. And Johnny Byrne specifically addresses that in his criticism of the production in Rekkaard's Doctor Who. I think that criticism is wrong. I think the story is not too bright, and I have two very good reasons why. But I want to hear your take on it first. Does the lighting in this story make it bad?
No, because, again, that's a common misconception I think this story has. And watching it again yesterday, I was quite shocked that literally every single corridor scene is quite underlit, and it gives it a real atmosphere. And you're thinking, this is not how I kind of like... And obviously the memory cheats, it's the famous John Nathan Turner phrase, isn't it? And I remember it being brightly lit and all the rest of it. But the scenes in the Silurian ship, you know, and the scenes where the sea devils come out of hibernation, that's very well lit, you know, from a 1980s BBC production point of view. The scenes in the corridors are fantastically like underlit. You know, there's a kind of like a grayness to, you know, the whiteness of the sea base. The only thing that I think lets the story down and where it gets this perception from is that all the scenes in the control room are very brightly lit. And I think had they used that same kind of like lighting that they had in the corridors, especially when, you know, obviously they're fighting against, like, you know, the Sea Devils and the Murker, then I don't think this story would have that myth attached to it that it's completely brightly lit and it's, you know, a poor story because of that.
So you and I are pretty much on the same page, because I was going to say my two defenses to the quote-unquote over-lit criticism. Number one, the Sea Devil's base is very dark and gloomy, so you need a bright set elsewhere in the story to offset that dark and gloomy set. Secondly, when you look at the brightly lit Seabase 4 bridge, whenever they go into missile run, the lights are turned down and it goes into emergency lighting. Yeah. That means that the brightly lit base, the brightly lit bridge, is not a fault of the director. It is a choice of the characters in the story, because if you're underwater, it's going to be dark and gloomy anyway. You would want the base to be bright just to keep your spirits up. And Terrence in the novelization even explains why the base has UV converters, because they need sunlight to counteract the effects of being deep underwater where light does not penetrate. So I don't think that's a fault. And I think Pennant Roberts does good direction here. If you look at the bridge, it's on two levels. There's, I think, a crane shot at the very beginning of the story. There's some really good reaction shots of Nielsen and Dr. Solow as they're trading evil looks during the conspiracy portion of the story. So, all right, I think we've done a good defense of Warriors, and we've, I think, exploded some of the more common criticisms. Let's talk then about the 1980s. So you and I are about the same age. You and I were both there. I know exactly where I was when 1979 turned into 1980. It's the first New Year's Eve that I was awake for. My parents took me and then our neighbors, the Blumenthals, we all went to see Kramer versus Kramer, which is perhaps not the movie to take a six-year-old boy to.
Probably not.
My parents were paying a babysitter for my two-month-old baby sister. They weren't going to pay for a babysitter for me, too. So I had to go and see Kramer versus Kramer at age six. And then we went to a local diner. And as the ball drops, as 1979 becomes 1980, one of the kitchen employees in the diner went running through the restaurant wearing a New Year's sash and no shirt, running through the dining room going, "Happy New Year," which you would never get away with today as an OSHA violation for so many reasons. Here's my question. Is Warriors of the Deep the first truly 1980s story? So Horns of Nymon is the first story aired in the 80s, but it's made in the 70s.
Yeah.
Leisure Hive, or as you would say, Leisure Hive, is the first story produced in the 80s. In terms of its look, in terms of costumes and graphics, is Warriors of the Deep, A, the first truly 80s ethos story, or is it, B, the most 80s story in all of Doctor Who?
I don't think it's the first 80s looking story, because there's certainly some 80s style hairstyles in let me think, Terminus, for example.
Oh, Lisa Gerrard was
very much of a like a bubble perm in that. They were all the rage in the early 80s. So yeah, it's definitely not probably the first, but I noticed that because you have the absolutely wonderful Ingrid Pitt here as a guest actor in the show.
Not just Ingrid Pitt. Ingrid Pitt's eyeshadow is a character in the story.
I was just about to mention that. You know, she's a beautiful woman. She's famous for appearing in some fantastic, like, you know, sci-fi horror films, The Vampire Lovers, lots of Hammer horrors, The House That Dripped Blood with John Pertwee. And obviously she's appeared in, like, you know, previous Doctor Who stories. They stick her, they cake her face in so much 1980s bloody makeup and eyeshadow. It's like you're thinking, is that Ingrid Pitt? Is it really? Because it doesn't look like her. And then she has this ridiculous, like the most 1980s style hairstyle. And then the kind of like the sea based costumes, the personnel with the different colors across the sashes and stuff. That's very 1980s with like the colors of like, oh, look, let's have the green and the reds together. That was very 1980s as well. So I think you've touched upon something there that certainly from a costuming and makeup point of view, it does embrace the 1980s very, very well.
So, yeah, the sea-based costumes would not look out of place in that most 1984 of genres, the Jane Fonda workout video. And the other point is the graphics. So I did not have a home computer in 1984, but we had just gotten rid of our Atari 2600. The discontinuity guide, while they are positive about this story in their summation section, the bottom line, if you turn your discontinuity guide to goofs, there's a lot of goofs. One of the goofs is Missile Command on the BBC Micro. The computer graphics in this story are 1984 as I remember living it. It reminds me of what my father was playing on the Atari 2600, because my father beat Missile Command. And it reminds me of the little – we had little microcomputers in our public school in 1984. It was two computers on trolleys. You'd wheel them to the classrooms as needed. But those are two computers in the whole school. Those are the graphics that I remember. So if you look at the Missile Run graphics on Seabase, that just takes me right back to what it was like to live in the 80s, even though it takes place 100 years in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's very much, yeah, that the BBC Micro, they did use it sparingly because obviously some of the graphics in Logopolis are done on the BBC Micro as well.
Oh yes, the when the Doctor is demonstrating the chameleon circuit on the TARDIS console. Yes,
yeah, it turns into a pyramid.
That a little kind palm tree, yes.
Yeah, and obviously the in Castrovalva, the TARDIS database or the instruction manual. That's like
the index file. If we had an index file, we could look it up in the index file under index.
Yeah,
file.
That's very 1980s BBC Micro. But yeah, obviously when they were doing the missile run, and effectively like all they can come up with was like the bright background with the very BBC Micro like font words like up on the screen, like, you know, either like with the green or the yellow or the red behind it. So yeah, if they ever do a replaced special effects for the collection box set, whenever they do, I'd like to see probably the removal of the BBC Micro graphics.
Yeah, season 20, the Blu-ray was just announced last month, but season 21, I imagine that they've probably already shot it. I don't have any inside information as to what they've shot, but you have to assume that as it's the last Peter Davison box set and they've already done 19 and 20, you have to assume they're already hard at work, if not done with the documentaries and the behind the surface, because we know they're further ahead with material for the bonus material than they are with the release dates, which are only two or three or four a year. I would love to see if they could do anything about the Mirka. I don't imagine they can. But yeah, if they could make the graphics a little more 2084 and a little less 1984, that might change some people's minds. When would you have first read this novelization? We were talking earlier. This is the first novelization that I have in publication order, which was printed after 1984. This is book 87. It's the first one that I have that was printed in 1985, which is unfortunate because this is a 1984 book. The first edition would have the original brightly colored Target logo. Since I have the 1985 edition, they replaced the original Target logo with this very sad monochrome logo, which was revealed in late 84. So in the 1980s, the decade of Jane Fonda's workout costumes, they turned the Target logo monochrome, which is an odd choice.
Yeah, same here. I mean, obviously, comparing the books, I've got the reprinted 1985 edition, so that's probably like when, obviously, I picked this up. And because I remember it was the town where I live, and there was a huge kind of like big... essentially, you would call it a newsagent's, you know. So obviously, the ground floor of it would be obviously magazines, newspapers. On one side, you get all the like the stationery, the sweets, the crisps, the chocolate. And then as you go further back into the store, because it was absolutely huge, that's where you had where all the books were. And obviously, they had like a science fiction section and a children's section. And I remember distinctly, it would be like a weekly thing to always go there, spend a bit of my pocket money, and I would either get a, you know, brand new Doctor Who Target book, or I'd pick up a Star Wars action figure.
Oh, which one is that? Is that Boba Fett?
They were on the second floor. This is actually one of the new ones. This is one of the new retro style ones of Boba Fett from Book of Boba Fett, that one. So that's not an actual original. They're all under my desk in boxes. But yeah, so NSS News Agents, as it was called, was like the go-to place to pick up your Target books. Occasionally, if they didn't have something in stock, there was a dedicated bookstore that was like further around the precinct that you could go into, but they had a smaller section because they weren't as big. So they tend to like didn't have as much Doctor Who books in as what the news agents did. So I must have obviously picked that up in 1985 rather than 1984.
And we are now past the era of the photographic covers. This is the first Peter Davison novelization that does not have a fully photographic front cover or does not have the little pop-up clip art photo of Peter Davison sticking out of the Neon Tube logo. I think this is a great color scheme because you have the lime green Neon Tube logo, which I don't think Target had ever done before. And then the color scheme in back of the Sea Devil is really neat. It's bluish, purple, green. It's a very underwater color scheme. So I happen to like looking at this book is aesthetically pleasing, never minding the text.
Yeah, and like you say, I think it's is it Andrew Skittler who's done the cover? And he was probably the go-to artist at the time. And it's a great rendition of like the Sea Devil in that kind of like samurai inspired costume, which, like I said, I absolutely love. I would love Character Options, who've got the action figure license, to do, because they recently, last year, did the Warriors of the Deep free figure pack.
Yes.
And I would love for them to do a Sea Devil pack if they could at some point. That would be brilliant. I'd buy that in a shop.
Which Sea Devil costume do you prefer? Do you prefer the mesh netting from the 1972 Sea Devils, or do you prefer this, the leather samurai costume? I think it's this all the way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that's not just because I'm a lover of Kurosawa samurai films as well. So I'm a bit biased in that regard.
Well, you can never go wrong aping Kurosawa. I mean, imagine if you have Throne of Blood as a Doctor Who episode.
Oh, wow.
So let's talk then. We've talked about Warriors of the Deep on TV. We've talked about Warriors of the Deep, the book. We've talked about the 1980s. We've talked about Ingrid Pitt's eyeshadow. The rest of the guest cast, maybe not the most interesting and dynamic set of actors in Doctor Who history. But what else can we say about this story as produced? What other common criticisms hurled at the story can we cheerfully rebut?
Well, I mean, the most obvious one is the Murker. But, you know, they did what they could at the time. I mean, how else would you have done that? You know, is that the responsibility of Eric Saywood as script editor to go, hold on, Johnny, you've done a sea monster here, essentially a big sea dragon. That's out of our budget. We can't really do that. Can we just keep it down to like the Legion of Sea Devils, or perhaps do something else in the meantime? But, you know, it's a good design. It's just let down by its execution. It's interesting that in the book, Terence Dix keeps it very, very brief with the description. Basically says that it's got big eyes, kind of like corrugated green scaly skin and fangs, which it doesn't have in the story, actually. The actual Murker itself doesn't have any fangs at all, just kind of have like a big wide mouth.
So Johnny Byrne has thoughts about the Murker, and he put them on Rekkaard's Doctor Who in November 1994. We are going to hear from Johnny Byrne later on in this program, but I assure you, he addresses your concerns about the way that the Murka is staged. I'm going to say this. If you have Matt Irvin on your DVD explaining how the Murka was made and comically apologizing for its presence, I would much rather have that than a middle-of-the-road, mediocre design monster which raises no objections either way and is then promptly forgotten. I would rather have the bad monster that Matt Irvin shows up to comically defend 10 years later.
Just as he does with Creature from the Pit.
Yeah, Creature from the Pit is a wonderful story, and anybody only remembers it for the wrong reasons. I'm not saying that Warriors of the Deep is as funny or as good as Creature from the Pit, but... yeah, that's where Johnny Byrne had something in mind which is not close to what was realized, and he thinks it should have worked better than it did.
And like I say, going back to obviously, you know, as a kid watching this story, it didn't bother me for a second. You know, I was engrossed in the story. I didn't like, you know, kind of like, you know, think that I was watching. And I know it's the common mistake. Right thing of that said about the Mercury is that it's dobbing the pantomime horse from Rent-A-Ghost, which was a big kids TV series on children's BBC at the time. And the two guys who were in dobbing the pantomime horse were the two guys who operated the Mercury.
Right.
But, you know, yes, it's lumbering. It's kind of like, it could have been shot a little bit better, I suppose, by Pennant Roberts. But, you know, as a kid watching it, I was absolutely loving the story. I wasn't seeing any criticisms at all.
So let's move on then to a game of 20 questions.
Oh God, here we go.
Question So you know the drill by now. You've been listening to this show for a long time. You've been on it before. I am one random Doctor Who serial from 1963 to 2022. You are going to guess using 20 yes or no questions which story I am, as randomly selected from the randomizer.net, a production of the Flight Through Entirety podcast. What is your first question?
Is it a classic series story?
Yes, you are correct with question number one. I am a classic series story. Question two.
Is it from the 1980s?
No, that's a very good guess because we've been talking about the 1980s and Jane Fonda workout videos, but this is a randomized selection, so no, I am not from the 1980s. Question three.
That's a bit of a red herring then, wasn't it? But like I say, completely random. Okay, so is it from the 1970s?
So you're working backwards in time. Yes, you are correct. If you had started from the 60s, you would have been wrong. I am a 1970 story, just as you and I are men of the 70s. Question four.
Is it a John Pertwee story?
Yes, it is a John Pertwee story. So you've now narrowed it down to 5 years of Doctor Who. Question five.
Does it feature Joe Grant as the companion?
No, it does not. Featured Joe Grant as the companion, and now you've narrowed 5 seasons down to 9 serials. Question six.
Ooh.
And that means you are guaranteed to win the game because there are less choices remaining than questions you have available.
Yeah, I could just basically ream off all the stories from season 7 and series 11.
And that would take a long time, but that's one way of playing, yes.
I won't do that, though. But I will do some kind of elimination here. So does it have Liz Shaw as the companion?
No, does not have Liz Shaw as the companion. You're now down to 5 serials. Question seven, I think.
Does it feature what we would now know as an established monster in the story?
Yes, it does. Question eight. If by established you mean returning, we only have 2 choices left.
Yes. 3 choices.
Well, the Santarans were not established.
Oh, right, yeah.
They were original to season 11. They didn't become returning monsters until season 12.
Is it written by Terry Nation?
Question 8, no, it is not written by Terry Nation, which brings us to question 9, which I suspect is your final choice.
Is it the Monster of Peladon?
I am the Monster of Peladon. Said hey. Nobody ever. Very good, you got it in 9.
That's better than the previous one, wasn't it?
Jim Saxer actually has the scorecard for every 20 questions game that I've ever played. I just don't have it to hand.
I think I did it in about 14, I think, in my previous one. Or 13 or 14, I think it might have been.
There have only been 2 people who did really badly. Bill Evenson got it in 19 with a little bit of help. Although Bill has played the game 3 times and has done much better the other 2. And then ChatGPT failed entirely. The one time that someone tried to program ChatGPT to play 20 questions for me. But 9 is very respectable, very solid. All right, Jason, we have a few minutes left. Where else can we find you and what's going on with your YouTube channel?
You can find me on Twitter at DjangoMac72, where I usually post ramblings about geeky stuff, including Doctor Who. My YouTube channel is called Bearded Geek Toy Reviews. Very close to getting 700 subscribers. Actually, at the time that this probably goes out, I hope to be past 700 subscribers. I've just put up a video about the latest Spider-Man No Way Home figure set, which has just been one of my first more successful videos. It's gotten nearly 600 views in 24 hours, which I'm really pleased about. So you can find me in those 2 places predominantly.
That's terrific. No, congratulations on the subscribers. Are you able to monetize yet, or are you still a few subscribers away?
No, you can monetize once you get to 1,000 and you have so many viewing hours in a year. So I'm close to both, naturally. And, I'm not looking for it as a career. I'm not, I'm far too old for that kind of thing. I don't want to become a YouTuber, but my ultimate aim is obviously if it becomes monetized, then it can kind of like pay for itself and just means I can buy more things to review on the channel.
That's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, sadly, you are about about 300 subscribers shy of 1,000. And I do not have an audience of 300 people yet, so I cannot make up the difference just out of my army of ghastly woke zombies alone. But I will post the link in the show notes to where we can find you on YouTube, even though I am strictly an oral medium. And I wish you the best of luck with that.
Thank you very much.
Jason, always a pleasure. It'll be a while before we have you back on Doctor Who Literature because my next year is pretty much fully pre-booked. But you and I will be seeing plenty of each other over on Trap One, where we are both regulars as well.
We certainly will do. I'll look forward to it.
All right. Have a great night.
Thanks for having me. See you now.
Doctor Who, Warriors of the Deep, by Terence Dix. Televised as Warriors of the Deep, teleplay by Johnny Byrne, televised in January 1984, paperback release date August 16, 1984, target book number 87, cover artist Andrew Skilleter. When the TARDIS materializes on Earth in the year 2084, the Doctor meets an old enemy, the Sea Devils. Once the masters of this planet, they are now forced to live in the murky depths of the sea, but their intention is to reclaim their position of domination. This will entail the infiltration of Earth's defense systems and the provocation of another world war, more terrible than any yet experienced, to bring about the complete annihilation of the human race. Not only is the first stage of the Sea Devils' attack successful, their associates in this dastardly plan are the sinister Silurians, also known to the Doctors of old. Warriors of the Deep is what I like to call a vanguard novelization, by which I mean, at the time of its release, it was the most recently aired TV story to be novelized. It's the first Season 21 book to come out, only 7 months after transmission, and Season 21 will come at us in a rush in book form, much faster than a lumbering Murka, faster than a squadron of Sea Devils, lumbering even more slowly through the brightly lit corridors of Sea Base 4. The first 5 21 season novelizations will come out all within an 11-month span, taking us through June 1985, basically spanning my entire 6th grade elementary school experience. The first book, coming out mere weeks before I discovered Doctor Who, the fifth, coming out just weeks before my first Doctor Who convention, a sixth, The Twin Dilemma, comes out in early 86, and the last, well, that has to wait for reasons having to do with rights and clearances until the 21st century, unless you count Paul Scoones' TSV fan novelization, which, and Paul gets very embarrassed when I tell him this, is much, much, much better than the actual novelization of Resurrection of the Daleks, put out by that show's own scriptwriter. But, at any rate, with one exception, which we'll come to later, I love Season 21 to pieces. Adore it. Even its much maligned premiere episode, Today's Tale, Warriors of the Deep. Looking again to the Doctor Who ratings guide for inspiration, I submitted my review, an earlier version of this essay, in October 2016. I had, shall we say, some strange fears and mysterious forebodings about the November 2016 U.S. presidential election, which had some professional consequences for me when all was done, and in the run-up to election night, I found that, for several weeks, I was unable to read anything more weighty than children's books. Seriously, for that whole month, all I read was my 1960s hardcover Hardy Boys reprints, several choose-your-own-adventures from the early 80s, and Target novelizations. When I looked up Warriors on the ratings guide, there was only one review, and it raised the counter-arguments against Terence that I've spent over 18 months on this podcast trying to rebut, hence this essay. My own premise, the Warriors of the Deep novelization, is Terence Dix at his stone-cold best. Warriors on TV, myself aside, is not very well loved. This is a fact, at least from the DWM surveys and Man on the Street interviews. The discontinuity guide, at least, is very high on it. Warriors was one of my earlier TV stories, and it had a big impact on me, the Part 1 cliffhanger, as UK Jason and I discussed earlier, leading me to believe that this was going to be a regeneration story. Remember, I would have seen this in PBS terms the day after Part 4 of the syndicated version of The Five Doctors, and at that time I was too young to know about TV seasons or that this was the season premiere in which doctors typically do not regenerate. I was too far out of the fandom loop to know that Peter Davison's Doctor was already dead when I saw this in December 1984, and that Colin Baker was the reigning Doctor Who. But let's remove my sentiment from the equation and talk about Warriors objectively. This I have already done on another podcast a couple of years ago, but I'll go on the record here too. Hey, my show after all. Set design, studio lighting, the Mirka, all things I've heard as black marks against this story, and that's easy to say with 39 years hindsight. I've heard it said that the returning villains are portrayed very generically, with none of the style that their creator, Malcolm Hulk, had imbued the Silurians and Sea Devils with in the early 1970s. The acting I've heard is nearly wooden across the board. Johnny Byrne, who wrote the thing, tried to defend the story when he posted on RecArt's Doctor Who in the early 1990s, but even he drew the line at the production and insisted that his scripts, as submitted, well, let's just hear from the man himself.
November the 1st, 1994. My script for Warriors always hinged on the Doc's sympathies for the Silurians. The first draft was indeed overlong, but not unusually so. And it was certainly no problem to a writer with the experience I brought to the show. It was my third Who, and before that I'd written most of the scripts and was script editor for the duration of Space 1999. What is true is that my script was massively rewritten by Saywood and the director without any reference to me. If I had been involved, the end result might have done justice to a story that merited enhancing, not the crude thrashing that ultimately showed up on screen. I certainly couldn't have done worse. Nothing excuses the presentation of the Mirka. If it couldn't be effectively portrayed in the flesh, and any number of excuses have been offered why it couldn't, then a little imagination could have transformed it into a creature of menacing presence. The Mirka, as portrayed, says all that needs saying about those responsible for translating my script to screen. Nor did I write that mother of all dropkicks, which was supposed to stop the Mirka in its track. The credit is all theirs. Did Saywood write, "There has to be another way"? Since it reflected the Doc's sympathy for the Silurians, which, as I say, was embedded in the script from an original story stage, I'm not so sure he did. And I might be able to check it out, if I can bear to dig into my archive hell. November the 2nd, 1994. Without a script, I can't remember the script changes in detail. And though my brain went into total denial when Warriors first showed up on screen, I remember the Mirka as menacing, unstoppable, and well-nigh indestructible. Nowhere did I describe it as a four-legged beast on loan from Panto Horses R Us. Nor was the double death at the end mine. I had the base captain live and the Silurian die. Given the dilemma of the Silurians, beings pledged not to kill, but driven by necessity to wipe out humans and manipulating events in a way that would honour the former and accomplish the latter, I felt that this situation had greater emotional impact. The Doc knew the Silurians, understood their thinking, ethics and values. He also understood what drove them to act as they did. His final line was an expression of his regret and anger, not at the situation in general, which is how it is played out on screen, but at the particular needless tragedy which arrogant mankind had inflicted on the noble-minded Silurian race. I did have a male double-dealing scientist on board the sea base, but nowhere did I describe him as a drop-kicking Rhine maiden. I was also very specific in my description of the base, rusting, leaking, virtually forgotten by all except those on board. The tension caused by neglect, decay, and low morale was demonstrated in the very first scenes, when the guy plugged into the weapon system computer completely bombs out. The onboard atmosphere and look, which I described in the script, later showed up something like in Alien, with the Murker essentially a lurking deadly presence waiting to reveal itself. There were other changes, a lot. But until I can lay hands on a draft of my script, I can't spell them out here.
Words written by Johnny Byrne, November 1994. Performed by Jim Sangster. Many of the contributors to that original RecArts Doctor Who thread, by the way, were and or still are friends of mine in real life, and two of them have been on this podcast. However, I did not post in that thread as far as I can tell. Not sure why. Must have been busy with law, school, admission paperwork. Thanks again to Jim Sangster for the dramatization. As Johnny says, most of those flaws held up against TV Warriors are production team flaws, and you can now watch the DVD special features and listen to the audio commentary for more on that. Any DVD to which Matt Irvin contributed is gold, by the way. The benefit of the novelization is that you can remove the production team flaws and produce the epic James Cameron-directed version of the story that lives in the mind's eye. And who better to do that than Terrence? Terrence's opening sentences are always a delight of world-building and word economy. It's a great trick. Two of his first four sentences, the base, might have been in space. It might have been in space, but it wasn't. Now, pull down a few EDA and PDA novels from the 1990s or early 2000s off your bookshelf and compare the opening sentences. Terrence's grab you. Other writers, not always so much. Now, there's not much that can be done to salvage the casting of the story. The dialogue given to most of the characters is strictly functional, and nobody's winning an Emmy Award. Commander Vorschach is played by Tom Adams, who had a big-ish part in The Great Escape, and Terrence here mentions that Vorschach, quote, had the rugged good looks of a recruiting poster hero, much to his own embarrassment. Now, if that description doesn't win you over on the character, then I can't help you. And for bonus points, Bulik, the Sea Base 4 security captain, is described as burly. I've said this before, but every sergeant in Doctor Who history is burly. That's pretty much all you need to know about Bulik, in a word count of one. Terrence wisely characterizes him as burly, and then gets out of the way. Terrence, to be fair, does recycle a lot of his earlier work. Clearly, his typewriter had macro keys for his cut-and-paste descriptions of the Fifth Doctor's outfit, TARDIS console room, and the Silurian submarine. Quote, its greenish hull had a rough, irregular surface, like something grown rather than manufactured. You'll find that description, or one like it, in perhaps a half dozen other Terrence adaptations. The earlier Terror of the Zygons and the forthcoming The Crotons springing immediately to mind. But this is where we get to the special stuff. The villains of the story are the Silurians and Sea Devils, and Terrence was there at their creation. These are his nieces and nephews, if not his children. He commissioned Malcolm Hulk to write those two stories. I know I've said variants of this line in other podcast episodes, including earlier today, but the genesis of that line was my original October 2016 review of the book, so I've left it in this essay. In this novelization, Terrence swoops in and gives us a lot of backstory and characterization, virtually none of which had been delivered on TV. Terrence also builds up the human inhabited world of 2084, in a way that the TV production did not. It's Terrence who describes this world's dueling Eastern and Western blocs with his trademark love of political zingers. Quote, worst of all, each side had come to believe in its own propaganda, to believe that the opposing bloc was populated not by human beings much like themselves, but by cold-hearted, ruthless monsters. Or, quote, Nielsen had no wish to die in defense of the base he was working to destroy. But enough about the 2016 U.S. presidential election. That's Terence describing an imaginary world that bears no resemblance to our own whatsoever. Terence also gives several more dimensions to Dr. Solow than Ingrid Pitt was able to do on TV. Solow is a thankless role, killed off in Part 3, and only on screen for a handful of minutes before that. But Terence psychoanalyzes the character and makes her almost tragic. Quote, "She had come to accept that most terrible of creeds, that the end justifies the means." Or, "Her voice was dull, almost lifeless. By now, Dr. Solow was becoming used to murder and treachery." And here's how Terence dramatizes Solow's death, presumably working from camera or transmission scripts, rather than from Johnny Burns' submissions. Dr. Solow ignored her, Lieutenant Preston. She ran round the corner, down more endless corridors, turned another corner, and found herself facing the Mirka. It was too late to turn and run, and she flung herself forward, kicking out at the Mirka in an attempt to force her way past. The attempt was doomed. The long tail lashed out, and she was thrown across the corridor, her body glowing and crackling with energy. As she slumped dead to the ground, the program disc rolled from her outstretched hand. The Mirka moved on. Ingrid Pitt was an accomplished martial artist, and that is a roundhouse kick she is trying on TV, not a drop kick, as Johnny Byrne identifies. The drop kick goes straight up. A roundhouse kick comes from the hip as your leg sort of steps over the chair. But at any rate, Ingrid Pitt would have been very good at that in real life. Does not quite work so well against the Mirka prop. Terence also provides lengthy technical descriptions of the Seabase 4 missile control apparatus, the SYNC-OP system, in which missiles can only be launched by a human brain interfacing with the base computer, and Silurian technology. When the Doctor uses UV light converters in Part 3, Terence explains why there are UV converters in an undersea base, and explains how the crew uses them. It's easy to take this stuff for granted as mere technobabble, but the TV episode dropped those ideas into the story without explanation, and it takes a Terence to actually decipher what all that stuff meant. Quote, "SYNC-OP technicians were in short supply. The training was difficult, sometimes dangerous, and only certain specially selected minds could cope. Sometimes, as in the case of Maddox, mistakes were made." Later on, "The Solarium was designed to counteract the effects of long spells of undersea duty. It was said you could even get a tan if you stayed in there long enough, though few people bothered." The human characters in the story may be largely cardboard, but in Terence's hands, they're cardboard moving through a very complex world. The TARDIS crew fares well. You can hear Terence mentally debating with Eric Sayward over the merits of adding an untrustworthy, shifty regular character, Turlo, to the TARDIS, not counting the Five Doctors, episodes 81A and 81B of this podcast. This is the only Turlo story novelized by Terence, but in this outing, Terence nails the character, calling attention to Turlo's cowardice and shifting loyalties in virtually every scene. Terence has Vorschach observe, a nasty, treacherous-looking type he was, too. Tegan gets a moment of triumph when she happily observes that the Seabase Guard platoon commander is female. That's a nice touch which you won't find in the TV version. And credit, I believe, to Pennant Roberts, who, as he often did, turned Preston from a male role into a female role to give us diversity in casting. Pennant would gladly join my ghastly woke zombie army of listeners, you see. And yes, Terence does save the Mirka. You can see Terence smirking, or if you will, smirking, at the idea of a dinosaur crossbred with an electric eel. But the Mirka does make sense in the book, mostly. Page 67, quote, "It was like a kind of pocket dinosaur, moving on huge back legs with smaller but still powerful limbs in front of it, a hideous dragon-like head, and a long tail." End quote. Later down the same page, quote, "It roared, more in anger than in pain." As Terence describes the Mirka's reaction to the pinprick blasts of the Seabase 4 Guard phaser weapons. Terence also cheerfully papers over plot implausibilities. Quote, "Fortunately, Bulik had a good knowledge of the base ventilation system. I've worked in many offices, and trust me, nobody on site ever has any idea how the ventilation systems work." Other plot holes Terence can't fix, the Doctor's last resort to save the sea base and humanity is to release hexachromite gas, which is harmless to mankind and lethal to marine life, and that sorts out the sea devils, except the Silurians are land mammals and probably should not have succumbed to the same gas. Eric Sayward and Johnny Byrne and potentially Terrence missed that one. Oh well. Is Warriors of the Deep a perfect book? Of course not. It's only 120 pages long. Given 250 pages, this could have been an all-timer. But novelizations weren't 250 pages long in the 70s or 80s. Part 4, as written, plays a bit rushed in chapters 10 through 12. The Doctor and Silurian leader only get two scenes together, and Terrence is a bit uncomfortable describing the huge body count at the end of the story. So the ache and disappointment of the Doctor saving the day but failing to save many lives is muted. On page 125, Terrence points out, quote, Bulik at least had survived, and there would be other human survivors scattered about the base. Bulik would have to take charge, explain what had happened to the astonished rescuers from the surface. Still, at least the missiles had not been launched. End quote. Not quite as tragic as the TV. But make no mistake, the novelization of Warriors of the Deep is one of the finer examples of Terrence taking a lower-ranked TV story and making it into a memorable, fast-paced, enjoyable book. I'm thankful this one exists.
You've done it! He did it!
He's alive.
The commander wasn't so lucky, I'm afraid. He's been shot.
Did I succeed?
Yes, Doctor.
They're all dead, you know.
There should have been another way.
Next time on Doctor Who Literature, we are going back and forth, up and down Doctor Who's timeline from book 86, The Dominators, made as part of season 5, to book 87, Warriors of the Deep, made as part of season 21. Next week, book 88, a season 1 original, Doctor Who's third ever historical adventure, and the second to be novelized. It is the first of three novelizations from early William Hartnell author John Lucarotti. We are going to be joined next week by Ross Aitken from Gallifrey's Most Wanted, Stop, Let's Team Up, The Runcible Report, and several other appearances on shows such as Trap One and Doctor Who Literature. Always a blast having Ross in the house. We are going to go back to 1964. We are going to go back to William Hartnell's first season. And we are going to talk about book 88, the novelization of The Aztecs. Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Jim also performed the opening musical number and narrated the words of the late Johnny Byrne. Special thanks to my special guest, Jason McLaughlin of Bearded Geek Toy Reviews. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, on Mastodon at drwhonovels@mastodon.social, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.